Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Florida Republican primary, where the polls have just closed and we'll be announcing preliminary results as they come in. Michael Tomasky, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, joins us. He's the editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas, and we will discuss this expensive, contentious, and increasingly venomous Republican primary that will leave the victor tainted and the loser defiant. Then joining us in the studio is Michael Kavanaugh, the director of the U.S. Policy and Advocacy at Health Gap, that's Global Access Project. He joins us to discuss what he considers to be a backdoor deal with corporate America, the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement the Obama administrator's U.S. trade representative has just made nearby in secret in a Beverly Hills hotel, a deal that leaves labor, environment, AIDS, and public health activists frustrated and confused. Then finally, Howard Schwaber, a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin, joins us. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. We will discuss Newt the Nasty, tonight's increasingly incendiary losing candidate who seems determined to carry on tearing down Romney, the establishment candidate, all the way to August when the Republicans convene in Tampa. And joining us now is Michael Tomasky, who is a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and an editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Tomasky.
My pleasure to be with you.
And it seems a bit of a blowout. I'm waiting for the figures, but the polls have just closed. what is the future of Newt the Nasty and Mitt the Mellifluous, if you heard him letting his hair down and being a regular guy by, apparently his idea of having fun is singing America the Beautiful.
Yes. Yeah, and not too badly, really, all things considered. Well, you know, I guess this is going to still be a long race. It looks like Romney is going to win this by 15 points, 16, 17 points, something like that. If Gingrich says he's going to stay in, then I guess he's going to stay in. But I really don't see how he can stay in as any kind of effective competition to Romney. let's think about 2008. Everybody remembers that on the Democratic side, that was a long race that lasted all the way until June. And even though it was pretty clear that Barack Obama was going to win, Hillary Clinton stayed in it. Why was she able to stay in it? Because she won some really important states in February, March, April, May. She won New York. She won California. She won New Jersey. She won Pennsylvania and Ohio. She won states that enabled her to make the argument, look, I won the key states that Democrats need to win the White House. So why would you send out into the general election the guy who couldn't win these key states? And it was a reasonably persuasive argument for a period of time. Gingrich, I just don't see, Ian, that he's going to be able to mount anything like that kind of argument. You know, he's going to win Georgia, probably. He's going to win a couple of southern states. But unless he pulls some big upset somewhere in an important big state, then I don't think that he's really going to be able to mount that kind of argument, and I think he's going to look sort of silly.
Well, at this point, CNN are already declaring Romney the winner with 47% of the vote, Newt Gingrich with 31%, Santorum with 12%, and Ron Paul with 8%. So the question would be, is this such a blowout that he's going to have second thoughts? I mean, or is he going to go all the way to Georgia? And presumably, if he sticks into Georgia on Super Tuesday, he's may even stay around till August.
He says he's going to stick around, so I think we have to believe for now that he's going to stick around. But as I say, I just don't think he can stick around all that credibly. But what the impact of him sticking around might be, if Sheldon Adelson continues to back his campaign, and if, you know, certain talk radio hosts and others who are on Gingrich's side and consider Romney a sellout and so forth keep beating their drums, then we're going to have more nastiness. And this, I think, is going to hurt Romney as he goes into the general election, possibly kind of badly.
So I guess you have to shake your heads and Michael Tabasky and recognize what a lucky guy Obama is, right? He ran against a nutcase, Alan Keyes, in his first Senate race. He ran against a sort of doddering candidate in 2008, whose economy crashed on his head. Yep. And then now he's got this fratricide going on between the Republican insurgent and the establishment candidate, that the bloodletting could go on for months, right?
I'm sure they're smiling at the White House tonight. No question about that.
So do you think then that there is a less than rational component here operating with Newt Gingrich? I mean, people say that he's taken what happened in Iowa quite personally, and that it's not just a competition for it's clearly not a competition for ideas and policies, is it? It's a competition of negativity. Apparently, 93% of the ads in Florida have been negative. But you would think by all reasonable counts he'd pull out.
Well, I think in Gingrich's mind it actually is kind of an ideological argument, and I can understand him thinking that. Romney was a liberal moderate when he needed to be a liberal moderate, right? Running against Ted Kennedy for Senate in Massachusetts and then running for governor of Massachusetts 10 years later. Now he needs to be a conservative, so he's being a conservative. So there really isn't much core to Mitt Romney. And I, even though I'm very much on the other end of the ideological spectrum, I can sympathize with Gingrich's argument that Romney is not a real conservative, and with the feeling among his partisans that is the case. So I think Gingrich does see it as an ideological argument, but I think his problem is that most Republican voters, even though they're probably not happy with Romney in certain ways, maybe in many ways, I think they seem to have decided that he's the best most plausible guy that they can send out there in November.
Well, even though with Michael Tabasky, again, special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas, even with this blowout in Florida, 47% to 31, seems to be pretty much how it's tracking. If you add up Gingrich, Santorum, and Paul, the anti-Romney candidates would win. So, clearly, this is a case where the Tea Party, the Christian right, none of them could get their act together sufficiently to get a consensus candidate. Had they gone to, found somebody like a Huckabee, where do you think the race would be now?
Well, that's an interesting question. A lot of people think that Huckabee would be rolling through this primary season, and I think that's reasonable conjecture. he has his weaknesses too, but he would have been a stronger candidate, I think, than Gingrich, who came with a lot of baggage, and Santorum, who lost his last election and lost it badly, and really wasn't that well known, and so on and so forth. And Ron Paul is kind of a little bit of a curiosity. He's obviously got some passionate supporters, but they are not, at the end of the day, a large percentage of people. So Huckabee probably could have taken Romney on in a more impressive way. But I do think it gets back to a question of who constitutes the GOP primary electorate. Since 1968, Republicans have basically voted for the next in line candidate. And a lot of people say that this time around there wasn't really a next in line person, but Mitt Romney was as close to the next in line candidate as you could get. He was an establishment figure. He did pretty well in 2008. It was always clear from the moment he lost in 2008 that he was going to be the guy who was going to try again in 2012. So he was pretty close to being, he was quite close to being the next in-line guy. And Republicans choose the next in-line person. Now, that might not always be true. If Barack Obama wins re-election, for example, that might not be true in 2016, which might be a really, really interesting Republican primary. if they're trying to take back the White House after 8 years of out of power.
I'd say the thing to look out for there, Michael Tomasky, would be if Governor Christie loses weight.
Well, yes.
I mean, exactly. You cannot carry all that weight around and be a presidential candidate. You'll drop dead, you know.
Yep, you cut right to the chase.
So, what does this say, though? About, I mean, your point's well taken about the Republicans being kind of orderly and having some kind of weird meritocracy, because Reagan had to wait his turn after he almost beat Ford. Right. Bush had to wait his turn after Reagan beat him. Dole, you know, waited his turn for God knows how long,
right.
Way past his shelf life, right? And so on, and so it goes. And so did McCain and now Romney. But what does it say about the Tea Party and the right wing of the Republican Party? They're not happy campers.
They're not. But Democrats and liberals should not deceive themselves into thinking that, you know, these people are going to stay home in November. They're not going to stay home in November. I mean, they, you know, hatred is usually a much better motivating factor than love in voting patterns, and they hate Barack Obama more than they love Mitt Romney, and that will guide their behavior.
But in the short term, are they going to hate Romney enough to stick with Gingrich so that he's a credible insurgent candidate and can stick it out?
I don't think so. I think that, as I said earlier, I think Gingrich will win a couple of states that he is expected to win. Georgia, maybe some other southern states, but the thing to watch for going forward here, I think, is can Gingrich pull off a surprise in a state that he's not expected to win? If he does that, the ball game changes. I don't really see it happening, but you know, I should tell your listeners that I've been wrong about a lot of things.
Well, you've got the first one's coming up is Nevada, which is largely Mormon. Most of the Republicans are Mormon, so that will go to Romney. Michigan, that will go to Romney, I think, because of his father having been governor, and he was born there. Maine, I think Gingrich is going to try Maine, but there's a big wait, isn't there, till Super Tuesday.
Right. Gingrich will try Maine, and it's worth remembering that Maine is, on the Republican side, is kind of a Tea Party state. The Republican governor of Maine won I can't remember, I'm sorry, whether it was 2008 or 2010, I think it might have been 2010, with a lot of Tea Party support, beat some more establishment Republicans in the primary. So the Maine primary electorate might be a little bit more Gingrichy, but it's New England. It's going to be Romney country. So where's the state? Again, I ask, where's the state that Gingrich is going to be able to plant his flag and say, "Look, I've done something really unexpected and impressive here."
Well, at this point, Michael Tomasky, 51% of the votes are in, and it's pretty much the same from the outset. It's 47%. For Romney, 31% for Gingrich, 13% for Santorum, and 7% for Ron Paul. Apparently, they count the votes fast in Florida. They've counted half the votes already.
Yeah,
but we know about Florida's ability to count.
No chads are hanging tonight.
So, well, just in closing, then, I mean, I suppose, you know, we can't be too optimistic in terms of it being a cakewalk for Obama. I know we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but we were saying earlier how incredibly lucky he's had to have weak or flawed opponents. And I think by the time Romney gets to run against him in after the August convention in Tampa, I'll ask you, what do you think? What kind of shape is he going to be in?
Well, I think he'll be somewhat damaged, and I think this is an important point. Now, a lot of people say, well, look again at 2008. Obama had to go through a long, dragged-out primary against a very tough and very famous and well-known opponent, and it didn't end up hurting him. It made him stronger, and he did win the presidency, so maybe that could apply for Romney as well. But I think if you look a little bit more closely at the dynamics of 2008 versus now, I don't think that argument really holds up. what Hillary Clinton did to Obama in April, May, June was that she forced him to make a case, make a bread and butter economic case to the middle, to working class voters. In other words, she kind of dragged Obama to the center, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I think. But as long as Gingrich stays in the race, he's not dragging Romney to the center. He's dragging Romney to the right. So I think the dynamic is completely the opposite of what the dynamic was in 2008. And I think it might actually harm Romney more than strengthen him.
Well, but Romney is you know, ideologically can turn on a dime. I mean, he panders to one side and the other. Look what happened in what's been happening down in Florida. He's been casting himself as an immigrant, you know, because his father was born in Mexico. We should look at his birth certificate, right? And he says, you know, I wish I was a Latino, but he's trying to appeal to the the Latino vote but only a month or so ago in Iowa, he was dead against the Dream Act and against amnesty. So you know, within a month he can turn. So
yeah, and he destroyed Rick Perry on the immigrant argument. I mean, that's really what put Rick Perry into the second tier and got him out of the race was Romney's attacks on Perry, you know, paying for the college education of children of undocumented immigrants. So he can turn on a dime, but I would think that in a general election context, those changes are going to be brought to voters' attention, let's say.
Yeah, there's a lot of video that the White House has been storing up, Ryan.
I would think so.
Well, thank you for joining us, Michael Tomasky.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Tomasky, who's a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and the editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back joined by Michael Kavanagh in the studio to talk about a secret deal that was made nearby here in Beverly Hills called NAFTA of the Pacific.
Nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do.
There's a limit to your love, like a waterfall in slow motion, like a map with no ocean. There's a limit to your love, your love, your love, your love.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Matthew Kavanagh, who's the director of U.S. Policy and Advocacy for Health Gap, that is Global Access Project. He has worked with a wide variety of NGOs and social movement organizations in the U.S., Latin America, and South Africa. He was previously the Global Campaign Director for Results Education Fund and Executive Director of Global Justice. His organizing work has ranged from water rights and apartheid reparations campaigns in Johannesburg to racial justice work with the Boston Youth Organizing Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Kavanagh.
Thanks for having me.
And apparently across town here in a swank Beverly Hills hotel, there's been a meeting of global corporate giants and the U.S. Trade Representative. These meetings have been secret, I understand, and you and a lot of activists have been on the periphery, shut out. What happened inside, and why are you upset about it?
So they're going on right now. And what's going on is that the Obama administration is in the middle of negotiating a free trade deal. It's called the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement. It's going to be very similar to NAFTA, only worse and bigger. It'll be the biggest free trade agreement that's the United States has ever seen.
That's the NAFTA of the Pacific.
NAFTA of the Pacific is what a lot of people are calling it. Mm. And right now they're trying to kind of sneak quietly into town, here into Los Angeles, into a pretty swanky Beverly Hills hotel. where they're negotiating the intellectual property chapter. And it's not public. It's closed to the public. They tried to keep it secret. They tried to prevent us from even knowing where they were meeting. But luckily, we've found out. And basically, what's at stake is the entire agenda around labor rights, environmental rights, access to AIDS drugs, all of these things that this administration is currently negotiating with 9 other countries, but they want to make it even bigger than that eventually. Once they get an agreement, they want the entire Pacific Rim to come together in one big trade agreement under a whole new set of rules that are, we would argue, really about favoring the 1% over the 99% globally.
So intellectual property is at the heart of the recent SOPA Act before the Congress, which has now been stalled because the internet people showed some muscle. Indeed. And they basically bowed the Hollywood people and never go back and redraft it. But at the heart of it, intellectual property concerns are real. Piracy is real. Hollywood, apart from the fact they're making lousy movies, they also are losing zillions of dollars to pirates.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a wide variety, and you know, I come from the health background, and as an AIDS activist, have come to this work on intellectual property, which seems kind of way high in the sky. And as you're saying, we kind of hear a lot about piracy and stolen drugs, and in the health world, we hear about, you know, counterfeit drugs, and that we should be so worried, and yet all of this is a little different than what's actually being negotiated, right? And so much like SOPA, right, there's these similar kind of things in which, all right, piracy is perhaps happening. Perhaps somewhere there are counterfeit drugs. But the response to that is not some
sort
of—
I think there really are a lot of counterfeit drugs, in India particularly. Cheap ones.
Cheap ones, right. But this is different, right? I mean, the difference between a counterfeit drug, which is, you know, pretends like it's real and doesn't work, and a drug that just pretends like it's Advil— Right? Yeah, as long as it's the same thing and it works, right? So these are different things. But I think the questions of intellectual property are huge and growing, right? I am not an expert on the kind of the movie business pieces, but I do know that the internet is abuzz with the SOPA pieces and the PIPA pieces, and the TPP is the next step in that, right? What they're trying to do is they're trying to say, let's require countries, all the countries that signed this free trade agreement, let's require them all to police the internet and make it a criminal offense to actually receive and possess copyright infringing materials, right? Now imagine this, right? The imagination of is it going to be a criminal offense to watch stolen cable, right? Is it going to be a criminal offense to receive poetry that's a takeoff on somebody else's poetry over the internet in a country, right? They're imagining ordering entire websites to be taken down in other countries just because, you know, it's copyrighted here. These are really different than piracy, where you've got a movie that's being stolen out of Hollywood. Totally different, right? There are ways that we can deal with that. On the health issue, we're deeply concerned because Big Pharma is making a huge grab here, right? They're trying to say they're really worried about generic drugs, which, you know, and I work a lot, you know, on HIV and with people living with AIDS around the world. And the price of, you know, Magic Johnson, right? He's a good Los Angelino. HIV positive. He takes something called Kaletra, right? It costs $13,000 per patient per year. He pays about $13,000 a year to take that drug. Well, now let's think about Zambia, right? $1,200 is the entire per capita for that entire country per person, right? There's no way per year, right? There's no way they're going to be able to pay $13,000 a year. The way that we've gone from having almost nobody on AIDS drugs and cancer drugs and all of those things in the developing world, right, has been to have generic drugs, most of them made in India. Right. Mm-hmm. And the way that the Indians are able to do that is they say that they have patents, but they don't give Big Pharma giant new rights to say, all right, if you just change the pill from red to blue, right, then you get a whole new patent. Well, here in the United States, we do that. Right. And that's what the Big Pharma is trying to export, is this whole new patent regime, send it around the world, make it intellectual property. And when it comes to life and death issues, the questions of intellectual property get a lot fiercer.
So I guess Big Pharma is trying to enforce an international agreement that protects its intellectual property. The question then becomes, when a drug is first created, that's when it has an intellectual, the value of its intellectual property. But then what they've been able to do is they've been able to extend the patents and the time before they become generic. And that's one of the rackets that goes on here. And that's why Big Pharma can give a senator, for example, $1 million.
Absolutely.
And he'd write a little rider in a bill saying that this particular drug needs the patent needs to be protected for past its shelf life. And that means billions and billions for us. So
billions. But
where do you draw the line between what is fair in terms of the investment that pharmaceutical companies make in the research and development of a drug? And how long can they make money out of it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's maybe let's take an example of one drug, right? So, again, I was saying that the drug that Magic Johnson takes, right?
It's
lopinavir ritonavir is the official name of it, right? Ritonavir was actually invented not by Abbott Laboratories that holds the patent, but by the National Institutes for Health, right? So we as taxpayers, we actually already paid for the invention of at least half the drug.
So was it given to Abbott?
What's that? Well, they took it from the basic science and then they took it to market, right? They did some research, right? Not none, right? But they did some, right? And then they took it to market.
Wow.
Last year, they made $1.5 billion off of that drug, right? So this question of we hear this all the time. Big Pharma invests billions of dollars in research. Well, at least half of that money that's being invested to make real drugs, not the next, the next impotence pill, right? But a real drug, at least half of that's coming from us already, right? And then we say, all right, you can make the money that you're going to make on it, but then there's certain limitations, right? You don't get it forever, right? You don't get to just keep on making small changes and continue the patent forever and ever. And especially internationally, right? When we start talking about Vietnam, for example, that's a party to this free trade agreement that the Obama administration is trying to do. Vietnam is a struggling country. They've got lots of HIV, right? They're trying to tackle it. They're trying to say there's no way we can pay this, right? And what pharma is trying to do is they're trying to say, you, Vietnam, have to adopt U.S.-style patent laws, right? Now, I would argue that here in the United States, they're not working very well for us, right? We're paying through the nose for brand-name drugs when we don't have to because we're kind of way out of whack. We're giving pharma way too much. But if you want to extend that even further, go to Vietnam and imagine that they have to adopt U.S.-style patent laws. That's going to mean people are actually going to die. And that, I think, is a line, right? When you're saying, literally, Vietnam cannot afford it, and therefore people with HIV will die, I think that's a pretty clear line that we can all agree on.
Well, we know that that there's something wrong with the system because drugs that cost a fortune here, you just drive across the Canadian border and they're much less. And if you drive south across the Mexican border, they're even cheaper. And we know, for example, that a lot of these AIDS cocktails that were developed over here, the Indians were able to put them all into one pill, keep
Absolutely.
It real simple, and that's all gone to South Africa and the Third World and saved millions and millions of lives. So this is clearly an issue of morality and humanity versus profit. To give us a sense of the forces arrayed. Big Pharma on the one side and what?
Well, and all the rest of us on the other side, right? Hopefully not just me. No. I mean, I think the AIDS activists worldwide are getting engaged, but so too are environmental activists, labor activists, all of these folks, because the free trade agreement here in Los Angeles, they've decided to sneak into town. And I think it's worth noting, right, that what they did yesterday, right, is that they, instead of meeting with public health officials, they told us there was no public events that were happening, et cetera, et cetera. They had to go with Fox Studios and have a tour of Fox Studios by the head of the government. Mental relations. Not exactly transparent, dear president. But regardless of that, right, they've kind of slunk into town to try to talk about intellectual property. But obviously, the battle is bigger than that, right? The battle is over labor rights, whether or not we're going to have a whole huge new trade agreement that actually exports even more jobs, right, that fails to actually protect workers' rights in the global south, right? Whether we're going to give corporations the power to challenge in court and in international tribunals our environmental standards, right, to say, oh, they lost profit off of it, therefore they get to sue us and sue the taxpayers. All of these kinds of things are at stake. And this is why tomorrow, on Wednesday at noon, at the Sofitel in Hollywood or in Beverly Hills, we're going to be out front, right? We're going to go. We're going to expose them. They're trying really hard to keep this as secret as possible. That's why I appreciate shows like yours that are willing to kind of bring it about into the light and say, actually, if we get the environmental movement, the labor unions and the labor movement and beyond labor unions, right, working people, we get the AIDS activists. If we can get all of those folks together, we can actually stop this free trade deal in its tracks.
So why do these countries like Vietnam agree to this? I mean, if you got on the record NAFTA, what it did to Mexico,
yeah.
it's basically destroyed Mexican agriculture. because it's so much cheaper to dump U.S. Yeah. grain down yeah. there, and created an even greater exacerbation between the rich and the poor. And essentially what the Mexicans did was export their poverty to the United States in the form of illegal immigration, and now that's drying up. Mm-hmm. But the richest man mm-hmm. in the world is a Mexican.
Yep. Absolutely.
So is this an agreement between the global oligarchs? Are aware that when you make these big agreements, it doesn't help the common people?
Well, I think you said it exactly right. Right, this is absolutely an agreement between the global oligarchs, and right now it's the United States, New Zealand, Australia, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei. It's a kind of a random grouping, right? And why is that? Well, it's actually because these are places where the United States feels like it has connection enough with the leaders, can push enough, can forward corporate interests enough, and where corporate interests are forwarding their own interests there, where they can come together and begin to craft an agreement. But, you know, if you look 2 years ago or 3 years ago, they tried to do the same thing in Thailand, right? And in Thailand, folks didn't step back and say, you know, we'll let the elites do it. Instead, they actually gathered 100,000 people and literally drove the negotiators out of the country, right? They chased them out of their hotel, chased them all the way, literally chasing them onto a golf course, and they had to, like, leave the country, right? They halted through people power, the negotiation of that agreement. Because this is the thing, right? When we pull this out into the light of day, you see a really different thing happen. But if they can do it quietly and behind the scenes, then we end up with a situation in which there's no way that the people get a say, right? Each time we end up putting a trade agreement before Congress, what happens? It passes, right? Because the corporate interests, the 1%, get in there, they push, they make it happen. We've got to stop it before it gets even close to there. And the only way we can do that is if we can kind of get a lot more attention to it.
So is China in this deal?
You know, it's not. And that's interesting...
That's very puzzling.
Well, and it's intentional, right? What this is, and if you kind of back up and kind of understand it bigger, is this is a bulwark strategy against China and India, right? India, on the one hand, is actually creating a new model for innovation, right? They're creating generic AIDS drugs. They're creating an entire industry based not on big pharma, right? But instead on lower prices and getting drugs to people. So U.S. pharma and European pharma hates that. So that's India, also not in the agreement. And then there's China, right? Well, what's the bulwark against China? They're worried about the Chinese industry, Chinese relevance in the area, Chinese power in the area. This is the United States gathering a group of countries to try to make an anti-China bloc and an anti-India bloc to try to create U.S.-style capitalist kind of dominance in the right. in the region.
But already with China, it would seem that the intellectual property is up for grabs. They pirate and they grab anything they can. But with companies like Apple have managed to put all their manufacturing over there to protect their investments. And there's a question now as to why they're, you know, people in this country couldn't pay an extra $50 for an iPad so that the workers could be working over here instead of this penury that they're working in these horrible kind of, you know, towers with, you know, cradle to grave corporate music around the clock.
And, totally. Yeah.
Hideous. Anyway, I think we've run out of time here. I thank you so much for joining us here in the studio, Matthew Kavanagh.
No, I appreciate you having me. And if you go to www.healthgap.org or citizenstradecampaign.org, you can find out information about what we're going to be doing kind of while the things are in LA. And I would just urge all your listeners, come out and join us at noon at the Sofitel in Beverly Hills and kind of expose for what's happening tomorrow at noon.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you again, Mark.
Thank you.
Matthew. Matthew Kavanagh is the director of the U.S. Policy and Advocacy at HealthGap. That's a global access project. He's worked with a wide variety of NGOs and social movement organizations in the U.S., Latin America, and South Africa. He was previously the global campaign director for Results Education Fund and executive director of Global Justice. His organizing work has ranged from water rights and apartheid reparations campaigns in Johannesburg to racial justice work with Boston Youth Organizing Project. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Newt the Nasty and his long march. Jefferson. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of books on the First Amendment, American Legal History, and Constitutional Philosophy, and scholarly articles on a variety of related topics. He is currently a visiting Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Howard Schwaber.
Oh, nice to be here.
And you're obviously a long way away from Florida, but this is the electronic age, and I'm sure you're in touch with what's happening there. Of course, it does seem that money has overwhelmed the race in terms of Mitt Romney's deep pockets and his ability to buy media in the various media markets in Florida. And it does seem, though, that Newt Gingrich is also, in terms of the politics of resentment, I think the person he most resents in the world is Mitt Romney. So whether it's personal or political, it looks like he's going to soldier on.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. It's not really so clear that money bought this election, although that's a convenient narrative. But we have actually some early exit poll results. And one of the interesting things is that, at least according to what people tell the pollsters, ads did not move people in a positive way. Some voters were turned off by the ads, and voters who felt that way particularly turned against Romney because the ads were viewed as unfair or too negative. But it was actually the debates that did the most, apparently, to sway voters toward Romney. It's also the case that in Florida there was only a very small number of voters who decided late. There were a lot of early and absentee ballots that were already locked in before the debates even happened, and the vast majority of voters say they made up their minds fairly early on. But of the voters who decided late, it was the debates rather than the ads that turned it. But the crucial thing is to realize we're only up to about 5% of the delegates needed for the nomination. This is a very, very long way to go, and Gingrich has made every indication that he intends to stay in it until the end.
Well, apparently the absentee ballots, 600,000 of which have been cast, I think about half of that number before the Gingrich victory in South Carolina, most of them are likely to go for Romney. And it would seem, though, from the latest indications from Gingrich on the stump, is that he's getting more and more incendiary. I mean, he's a man on fire.
Well, that's one way to put it. His statements are becoming more and more like the slightly out of control Newt that we know and love from the past. I think he hurt himself quite badly by proposing a 51st state consisting of a colony on the moon in his second term. And some of his attacks on Romney are becoming over the top, let's put it that way. But there are states coming up in which he will be quite strong. There's particularly just today, or I guess today my time, today or yesterday, depending which part of the world we're in, a new poll just came out that shows both Gingrich and Santorum very, very strong in Ohio and Missouri. Those are two big states with very strong evangelical populations. Those are both places where Romney could have a real challenge on his hands. So this is very far from over, and there are a lot of states coming up where Gingrich or Santorum could do very well. And if one of those two were to drop out, such that the evangelical and really hardcore conservative voters would coalesce around just one candidate, Romney could have a very serious fight in his hands. This thing is by no means locked up after today.
Well, had it not been for the divisions on the religious right and amongst the evangelicals and conservative Republicans who control the party, or at least dominate the party, it would have been all over. I mean, had they united around a candidate like a Huckabee, for example, I don't think that Romney would even be where he is today. He's been lucky in that regard. But coming up next week is Nevada, and then you've got Maine and Michigan. I think in both Nevada and Michigan, I don't think Gingrich is even going to try, because there's so many Mormons in Nevada. And Romney, of course, his father was the governor of Michigan. So Super Tuesday seems to be the best bet, right, coming up for Gingrich.
It is, but we're entering a doldrums period. For the next several weeks, there just isn't very much going on. I think you're exactly right about Nevada and Michigan. One state to watch is Missouri on February 7th, which is, it's a non-binding primary. It's sometimes called a beauty contest. But polling data, as I said, suggests that Gingrich and Santorum are both very strong there. Arizona is also probably worth watching on February 28th. But then you're right, it's March 6th, Super Tuesday, where the real action occurs. And those states include Georgia, which is Gingrich's home state, Massachusetts, which we presume Romney will take in a walk, Ohio, where Gingrich is very strong, and the kicker is Virginia. And the reason that I say that is Gingrich could be expected to do quite well in Virginia, but he's not on the ballot. His campaign did not succeed in getting him qualified in time. So we're going to get a kind of a false result from Virginia that could skew the race. But it will be important to recognize that that is a false result.
Well, apparently, Howard Schwaber, a lot of the voters down in Florida in exit polling identified themselves as Tea Party voters. So the blowout that everybody's expecting may not happen.
Well, there's a very strong Tea Party movement in Florida, but there are a couple of things going on here. Turnout is always important. Early voting is important. And Romney not only had complete domination of the airwaves in terms of ads, but on the ground, complete domination of the ground game, that is, the organization in place just in terms of people to go door-to-door, to make phone calls, to have local offices, was vastly superior to anything Gingrich could throw together. I do have some early unofficial results that suggest Romney's ahead by about 14 points. If that holds up, that's certainly a serious and decisive victory. But again, this is only the 5% mark. If the Gingrich has already given a couple of speeches in which he's basically said that his strategy is to come to the convention in a situation where there's a large block or even a majority of delegates who are opposed to Romney, and then try and get all of those anti-Romney delegates to gather around his banner. That's a strategy that can actually work. It has some difficulties, and particularly in terms of picking up Ron Paul supporters. Ron Paul is likely to do well in the caucus states that are coming up, such as Nevada and Colorado, maybe even Minnesota. So there are some definite, you know, fractures within even what we might think of as a putative anti-Romney coalition. But in principle, at least, Gingrich is unlikely to have any reason to drop out and will try and take this thing all the way to the convention. And the Florida results won't do anything to slow that down.
Again, I'm speaking with Howard Schwaber, who's a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. So this has got to be causing heartburn amongst the Republican power brokers. And, you know, I don't know about how much smoke is in their smoke-filled room. They're probably all non-smokers, but
the ones from tobacco states,
exactly. And maybe their power is being exaggerated, but they have to be literally terrified that this is going to be another 1964 where the Goldwater insurgency, a Tea Party-like conservative movement swept him and swept aside the establishment candidate, another billionaire or multimillionaire Rockefeller. And they don't want all of this fratricide going on all the way till August in Tampa, surely.
Oh, I have never seen an election in which the party leadership of either party was so unified in its detestation of a candidate who's posing a serious challenge. Maybe you have to go back to 64 to see it. The parallels are actually not bad. Not only is Romney a very wealthy man, as Rockefeller one was, they're both Northeast old-school Republicans, sort of pre-Tea Party, even pre-1980s moral majority-style Republican candidates. Who are loathed by the evangelical voters and the Tea Party voters and what we might call the new right that emerged during the Reagan era, but are very, very well entrenched with the leadership. The Republican Party leadership hates Gingrich, first of all, for lots of reasons, some of them personal, some of them valid, and some of them petty. But most of all, they are, as you say, terrified of him, of the havoc he can wreak in the party. And they think he's genuinely unstable. I mean, not only a beatable candidate, but a candidate who could damage the Republican brand for years to come. He does have a tendency to make wild statements. Somebody once said about him, Newt has 10 ideas a day, 2 of them are good, 6 of them are weird, and 2 of them are really very weird. And on a national stage, that not only doesn't play well, it looks crazy. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think the party leadership is terrified of Gingrich. And if we come to the convention in a situation in which Gingrich, Romney is weak enough that he looks defeatable, and Gingrich looks like he could put together a coalition of delegates, let's say on the second ballot perhaps, to pose a challenge, it's not impossible we'll see a genuine brokered convention. It's hard to do these days because delegates aren't bound the way they were 30 years ago. But in principle, it is still possible to have the various factions sit down and try to negotiate something. And this could become quite a wild ride indeed.
In your Huffington Post article, Howard Schwaber, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment, you say that that Gingrich has become the perfect expression of what Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style of American politics, in as much as he's preying on resentment and he's mythologized this elite. He said in some of his campaign speeches, he talks about how, for example, in his win down in South Carolina, he said, "I didn't win because I'm the superior debater, as the mainstream media say. I win because I know how to connect with the real American people." And he keeps talking about how somehow the American establishment is unpatriotic, and for 30 years they've taken America on the wrong path. And he is galvanizing those people out there, that silent majority who recognize the decline and fall of American values. I'm paraphrasing clearly, but at times it's all in code, and it's all rather bizarre for somebody. For example, I come from where you are now, and I see this country as being incredibly patriotic and by and large very right-wing. So I don't know what he's talking about.
It isn't always all that coded, particularly when he starts talking about judges, for example. The Ninth Circuit and a particular federal judge in San Antonio, Texas, of whom he is not fond, he accuses them, and he accuses the Obama administration, of deliberately trying to, in his sense, destroy America. He isn't talking about people being misguided or wrong-headed or making mistakes. He talks a language in which there is a group of elites who are deliberately conspiring to destroy American culture and replace it with something alien. And it is bizarre. This is the reason why, there's good reason to think that Gingrich as a national candidate would be a flop, because most people look at claims like that and they sound, frankly, paranoid. It resonates very well with a very angry and very resentful base in the Tea Party movement and among some evangelical voters. It resonates well. For example, there was a letter read to Catholic churches in Florida, apparently, just yesterday, accusing the Obama administration of destroying religious freedom because the Department of Health and Human Services has ruled that Catholic medical institutions have to provide coverage for contraception. So he's drawing on some of that religious resentment and a feeling that secular elites are trying to destroy a religious way of life. He draws on a kind of nationalist resentment, which he accuses the elites of bringing in foreign or European or non-American or alien. These are all words that he uses. Cultures and ways of being and trying to impose it on Americans. But the real striking thing about his rhetoric is the extent to which it's all a deliberate conspiracy by evil actors as opposed to merely misguided politics. And so he is rallying the troops to come to the barricades to fight against these evildoers. It's remarkable that there are as many voters as there are in what is a generally central right country who are persuaded by that narrative. And what's even more remarkable is how many of these same voters are buying into this narrative when 10 years ago or 20 years ago, certainly what they would have been looking for, those same groups of voters, would be something much more positive, much more a matter of looking for someone who expresses their values, shares their norms, and is a good person, whereas now they seem eager to line up behind a man who is selling himself as basically a bomb thrower.
But Howard Schwaber, do you really think that Gingrich believes what he's saying? I mean, do you think he really believes that President Obama is a Saul Alinsky radical? And that there again, that's all code, foreign, Jewish, weird, radical, subversive, and that he's the food stamp president. And, this is the guy that sat down with Nancy Pelosi and made a pitch for something to be done about global warming. When he took money from various lobbying groups, he was faithful to whatever their needs were. So he seems to be somebody that can sort of turn on an ideological dime, yet all the stuff that you're saying, all of which is true, and it is not in any way mediated, it's quite poisonous. But does he believe it?
We're getting into the realm of psychological speculation here. But consider his most recent claim about Romney, in which he says that Romney denied kosher food to Holocaust survivors in a Jewish hospital in Massachusetts, thus proving that he is, I'm not really sure, anti-Semitic, heartless at least. Could he possibly believe these things when he says them? The thing that strikes me about Newt Gingrich, and I'm not the first one to say that, is that he will say mutually contradictory things on two consecutive days, and in each instance give every indication of believing them absolutely. My best read on the guy is that at the moment he's speaking, he absolutely believes whatever it is that he's saying, and then he has essentially no memory of having said it.
And
I'm not sure what the psychological term is for that. There's an element of narcissism involved, I think. He creates reality inside of his own head and expresses it, and if what's inside his head changes, then the reality has changed, and that's all there is to it.
Well,
at the moment, he's doing very, very well at channeling a particular message that a particular category of voters wants to hear, and he's certainly presenting it with the utmost sincerity.
Well, when you say, Howard Schwaber, that you know you would have thought that the American electorate would be more centrist, it is a center-right country, and that it wouldn't find this kind of incendiary rhetoric appealing, there is another, I think, possibility out here. There does seem to be a lot of anger, a lot of disquiet. When you consider that the Tea Party were the ones that captured the anger about what happened on Wall Street instead of the political left that should have owned that issue, and they ran with it, and now they've elected a bunch of people, all of whom are working assiduously for Wall Street, that Wall Street has completely come back. The very people who took the global economy to the brink of extinction now seem to have as much influence, if not more influence, over our politics than ever. They've been able to keep the Bush tax cuts in spite of lots of efforts to overturn them. So this is a peculiar time in America where the oligarchs, if you will, are discredited, yet they are flexing their muscles in an unprecedented way.
Well, I think that's exactly right, but I think that the point is not to see this in terms of left and right. There is lots of very good reason to be angry, and you've just named a few of them. And people on the left, as well as on the right, are very disappointed in the extent to which the Obama administration is still very closely tied to Wall Street. And fairly or unfairly, you know, the presence of Tim Geithner is sort of the personalization of that relationship. But it's not really about left and right, it's about populism. The Tea Party is a right-wing populist movement, and there's a long history of right-wing populism in the United States. You know, you mentioned Goldwater. You can also think of someone like William Jennings Bryan. Gingrich is drawing on a very deep strain of American political culture. It goes all the way back to the Jacksonian period in some form or another, that is suspicious of elites in the big cities who are running things, who are the tools of the banks. You put all that together, and that's a very potent left or right-wing populist message. And that's exactly what Gingrich is doing. What's striking on the other side, on the Democratic Party side of things, is how ineffective Obama has been throughout his term at drawing on left-wing populism. All of the populists, you see it, the left-wing populism in the Occupy movements, but you really don't see it very much at work in the Democratic Party. So all of the populist rage and energy that's being effectively channeled to politics right now is coming from the right. But the phenomenon cuts across those ideological lines.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Howard Schwaber. It's an odd conversation that we're having on the night of the Romney victory in Florida. Here we are talking about Gingrich, but he is clearly more interesting than Romney.
Well, he has this ability to suck all the air out of the room, even when he's losing. You can't look away, whether you're loving the show or staring in horrified fascination. It's an amazing spectacle.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Howard Schwaber, who is a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of books on the First Amendment, American Legal History and Constitutional Philosophy, and scholarly articles on a variety of related topics. He's currently a visiting professor. He's actually a Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. And, of course, I spoke with Howard just shortly before we went on the air, and we were guessing the results, which have tracked pretty consistently with 50% of the vote in. Romney is at 47%, Gingrich at 32%, Santorum at 13%, and Ron Paul at 3%. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began the program just as the polls closed in Florida and were able to give an update throughout the first part of the program clearly it was a pretty much a blowout for Romney, 48-37. About half the votes were counted. We know how they count votes in Florida, right? I had Michael Tomasky on as a special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and we were talking about this particularly venomous race and how apparently Gingrich, is in spite of the whipping he's getting, it doesn't look like he's going to restrain himself from continuing. Michael Tomasky seemed to think he has it. If he pulls off another win, an upset win somewhere else, he can stay in the race. The most likely one would be in Maine, given that the next one is Nevada and Michigan, both of which Romney's got an advantage in Nevada because of the Mormons and an advantage in Michigan because his father was governor. So it's not likely that Gingrich will make a dent there, but he may make some kind of a dent in Maine. But if he can pull off something like Georgia on Super Tuesday, then he can stay in there and be this bomb thrower all the way to August, which of course is music to Obama's ears. And again, you keep reminding yourself that, boy, is Obama lucky, because there's no question that by the time they get to the convention in August in Tampa, the Republicans are going to be pretty beaten up. It seems like every day that passes, it's an indication that nobody's particularly thrilled with the candidacy of Romney. But the Republicans are very hierarchical, and people have to wait their turn. Reagan had to wait his turn, and Bush Sr. had to wait his turn, and John McCain had to wait his turn. And this is the turn of Mitt the Stiff. So there we have it. Then I was joined in the studio by Matthew Kavanaugh, who's just been demonstrating in front of a hotel here in Beverly Hills, where the U.S. trade representative is meeting in secret with a bunch of titans from corporate America, particularly from Big Pharma. They're hashing out a new free trade agreement with the Pacific, which is being dubbed the NAFTA of the Pacific. And this is a deal that's leaving a lot of labor, environmental, and AIDS activists frustrated and confused. And Matthew Kavanaugh is an AIDS activist who spent a lot of time in Africa, and is pointing out how, but for the fact that the Indian Big Pharma doesn't pay the kind of royalties to American Big Pharma, they're able to provide AIDS drugs in Africa. He made the point that for Magic Johnson to stay alive, it's $13,000 a year. But the same drugs they can afford to give them away in poor African countries like Zambia. And by the way, $13,000 a year is the entire annual salary of somebody in Zambia. So he's clearly fighting the good fight, and this one's going under the radar. So it's something that we're going to have to do a lot more coverage on. And then finally, I spoke with Howard Schwaber, who's a professor of political science and law at the University of Wisconsin. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Newt Gingrich and the Politics of Resentment. And even though Newt the Nasty is losing this election, he's a hell of a lot more interesting than the guy that's winning it. And he certainly seems to be determined to tear down Romney all the way to August. And we were trying to talk about the nature of the politics of resentment, what it is that attracts the sort of Tea Party Christian conservatives to this candidate who is hardly a poster boy for family values, and what is at the heart of this nastiness. And I think to some extent we answered those questions. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.